Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Susan Ibach, who is empowering developers to improve the world. Susan, you have this amazing background. I mean, electrical engineering and working in various capacities, ITIL, you name it, you've done it. You're kind of a renowned here in Canada. So thank you for coming in today to share your deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to it. It's always a pleasure to be able to share some of the things you've learned over the years and some of the experiences you've had.
Now, Susan, I want to mine all of this experiences that you've got. Can you detail your major prior roles and then some shareable lessons you've learned from each of the roles that the audience would find valuable?
Well, sure. The first big role I took was I worked at Anderson Consulting, which these days is known as Accenture. And there I worked as one of their consulting team. And that was a really interesting position because you hopped from role to role fairly quickly, quite often being dropped into a new team. So one year you're working as a tester, the next year you're working as a programmer, the next year you're working on rollouts and conversions of applications going live. And then the next thing you know, you're doing configuration management. I think one of the lessons I learned that was so important to me there was the value of having a process in place. Sometimes people see process as just overhead and extra work, but I can tell you with the quick turnover of roles and the need to get up to speed quickly when I was put into a new role, the processes we had in place were absolutely invaluable. And it's something I've really taken with me to every role I've done since, where whatever I'm doing, I sort of ask myself, hey, you know, worst case scenario, if I was hit by a bus tomorrow, would somebody else be able to come in and pick up where I left off? Or if a new teammate was coming on board because I wanted to do a new role, you know, happier reason to be moving on, would somebody be able to take over and move on? And I think, you know, the consulting firm did that extremely well and really ingrained into me that the value of having processes that are in place. So I think that was probably the best thing I learned when I was working at Anderson Accenture. When I worked as a manager for a while, worked as a manager in a couple of different positions, one of the times I was at a training company. I spent a number of years working at a training company and at one point ended up being the instructor manager. Also, even when working as just programming supervisors and managing a team of programmers, one of the interesting things I learned was in dealing with the different types of personalities. I remember somebody describing kids and saying to teach kids, there are some kids, you tell them the stove is hot, and they say, okay, I won't touch it. There are other kids, you tell them the stove is hot, and they have to go touch it, and then they burn themselves and go, you're right, it's hot, and now I've just burned my finger. And I discovered that that method of learning and teaching and mentoring people is true in the workplace as well. Whether it was a programmer who kept saying, yeah, I'll meet the deadline, yeah, I'll meet the deadline, when you knew they weren't going to meet the deadline. You could warn them. You could point out the challenges they were going to have meeting the deadline, but they wouldn't believe you until they'd missed the deadline themselves. So I really discovered that for some people, the best way to manage and mentor them is to give them room to make the mistake and be prepared, have everything ready to deal with the mistake when it happens. Because that way they have that opportunity to learn it from themselves. It becomes a lesson they will remember. And you're not doing it because you're out to get them. You know, you're prepared to catch their fall and help them through it. But I found that really important working as my first positions in leadership and management type positions for trying to work with my staff and be successful with my staff and helping them. I spent a number of years working in Anderson, different roles, different leadership roles. And I also spent a good 10 years doing training, teaching people how to do programming, teaching people how to work with databases, teaching ITIL, for example. I've got a couple of certifications in ITIL now. And one of the things I found there is learning that it was okay to say you don't know the answer. When you are every week faced with 10 to 15 professionals in the industry, and you're standing in front of them talking about a variety of topics, eventually you're going to be talking about a topic that someone in the room knows more about than you do. And that's okay. And when somebody asks you a question you don't know the answer, you're going to gain more credibility by saying, I don't know. And if there's someone else in the room who does know, saying, you've worked with this before. Have you encountered this issue? Or do you happen to know the answer? Really seeing someone else who may know more about a topic than you as an ally rather than a competitor has been a really valuable thing for me and helped me much more successful as a trainer. So both simply being able to say, hey, I don't know the answer, rather than trying to fake it and perhaps lose credibility, and also just to look around me and ask myself who might know the answer and might be able to help me out in this situation. And that's something, again, that I've been able to take to all the other roles I've worked in since.
Can you extend the last question then to your current role and some lessons you've learned in your current role?
Well, in my current role, I'm working as a technical evangelist for Microsoft. And as you can imagine, technical evangelism basically means I am helping developers adopt and understand the newest developer technologies. That's a very broad mandate. So I think the biggest thing I've had to learn in this particular role is the importance of prioritizing your work. There are thousands, literally thousands of things I could be doing on any given day to help developers in Canada be more successful. But somehow I have to decide which things can I do that will be the most effective. So I could get an email from a programmer saying, hey, I'm having trouble with my code. Can you help me find someone to help me fix that code? I would love to be able to sit down with that person, look at their code and play with that code and find a solution. But I have to take a step back and go, wait a second, you know, there are over 1 million developers in Canada. Is me spending 2 hours helping one person fix their code the best use of my time right now? So then I have to think about things like, well, maybe what I need to do is look at the problem they're having and ask myself, are others having the same problem? Would a blog post about this be effective? Is this a challenge many are facing, and maybe we should organize some sort of webcast on these particular technologies that so anyone else with the same problem can help resolve it or avoid hitting that problem in the first place? So in my current role, the biggest lesson I have really learned would have to be prioritization. Other goals, other things I've really learned, and this I've really applied in my current role, I've learned it a little bit over the years, is the importance of leveraging everyone around you and working together. You know, I remember when Stephen Covey's Seven Habits book came out, it was really popular, and it talked about the win-win. And it became almost cliche to look for win-wins, but I honestly do believe in looking for win-wins. At Microsoft, it's a huge company, so many people working in so many different areas. We've got teams who are focused on SQL Server. We've got teams who are focused on helping students. We've got teams who are focused on Windows Phone. We've got teams that are focused on recruiting students to work at the company. So one of the things I really try to do as I meet different people in the company is I sit down and talk to them for 5 minutes and just learn what they're trying to achieve in their role. My team, for example, one of the things I do is I do a lot of work with university students, helping student developers. And we were sponsoring a global game jam in Vancouver. And this is a fun event. We got a chance to talk to some game developers about the fun stuff they could do on Windows Phone and with Kinect. Well, it turns out in Vancouver there's also a gaming studio. So I was able to get a hold of somebody at the gaming studio, and it turns out they hire co-op students in that area. So I had a chat with them, and we arranged for them to come to our global game jam event. This was an absolute win-win because we'd already paid to sponsor the event. We were able to bring some members of the Vancouver studio to meet some actively developing games who were potential recruits for co-ops. It was exciting for the students because for a lot of gaming students, their dream is to work at a gaming studio when they graduate, so a chance to meet them. It helped us out as well because we didn't need as many people there to support the event because they were helping us out. So I'm always looking for how the other teams and the other groups I work with can work with me and literally help both our goals by working together. So that's something that I think anybody, especially in a large company, it brought back to me the value of learning what others are doing and how we can help each other. And the last thing I've learned, this is the first job I've had where I work at home. And it's a very strange thing to work at home every day and talk to your laptop when you have meetings, and sometimes your laptop talks back. That's sort of how I describe my day-to-day job. I talk to my laptop, and it talks back to me. But one of the things that happens is you can become very isolated when you're working at home. So another interesting thing I've had to learn is the importance of walking out of a door from time to time and getting out there to an event or a user group or a conference to get re-energized. Because working at home every day can get a little isolated, so it's fabulous to just get out every now and then and make a point of going out there and talking to people in person from time to time.
Susan, you mentioned this fact that you're now working with universities. So how are you supporting universities?
Well, Microsoft has a whole bunch of great programs in place that I can leverage to help support universities. For example, we have the DreamSpark program. The DreamSpark program allows universities to get software for free. That way they don't have to pay for licenses. In particular, computer science and computer engineering type faculties can get what we call DreamSpark Premium, and that basically gives them access to all our developer tools for free, so they don't have to pay for any licensing. And that way, if you want to teach students how to do programming, you can do so without having to worry about any sort of barriers of adoption. You don't have to worry about any costs associated with getting Visual Studio. So that's one of the ways we do it. Also, we'll do things like guest lectures for faculty. I was literally composing an email about 15 minutes ago to a faculty member who was asking if somebody could come by and talk to his students about what's going on in the industry, what's coming down the pipe. We've done guest lectures to students in gaming classes to talk about where are the opportunities and how best to approach developing on our platforms. So guest lectures, sometimes we sponsor conferences, which, you know, helps the student communities that are doing some really innovative stuff. Those are probably the major ways that we get involved with universities, at least on my team.
And I guess this would extend to colleges and institutes as well.
Absolutely, yeah. When I say it's any higher education institution, so we deal with constitutions, polytechniques in Quebec as well.
Now, I know that you also talk a lot with computing professors and instructors and engage with them. What are some of the other ways that you empower all of these impassioned faculty members from across the country?
Well, there's a lot of resources, and this is one of those places where it's been great to learn what some of the other teams have in place. Microsoft Research has some great resources for finding other faculty members and their resources. We have a number of software development kits that make it easier to leverage our technologies. For example, Connect, which came out recently, is a very popular area of research because a lot of professors are interested in creating new user experiences or in doing remote work. So I'm making sure people have things like the SDKs available is a way we try to help them out. We also have a whole website and series of newsletters called the Faculty Connection. And on the Faculty Connection, professors can even download complete courses with the slides, with exercises, with suggested assignments for the students to complete. So, you know, if you're trying to put together, you're curious about the technology, you're going, well, you know, I'd love to teach my students HTML5, for example, but I don't have time to create a course. We literally have a course on HTML5, which we, the faculty, are welcome to download and use.
I know that the ACM recently had their first webinar in January, but there were two Microsoft researchers associated with this, and all about Project Hawaii. Isn't that something to do with universities, too?
Yeah, Project Hawaii is a really neat, that's one of those examples of what Microsoft Research is doing. What they've done with Project Hawaii is they've created a number of different Azure services in the cloud. And these, I can't remember off the top of my head exactly what the specific services they have available are now, but basically they've created services and written software development kits for them that can be reused by faculty, and they're making them available. So they're designed to help professors who are doing research to do more innovative work by giving them some of the pieces of the puzzle and saying, here, we've built this piece for you. Why don't you go ahead and use this any way you'd like to? So we do try to provide said tools and components that that are very reusable for professors doing research.
I guess it kind of brings to mind sort of three hot topic areas: big data, the cloud, and mobile. And I believe Project Hawaii kind of helps in all of those areas.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, Project Hawaii is built in the cloud. It is Azure. It does enable big data because some of the services help with the consumption of data as well. And everything in Project Hawaii can be consumed over mobile. So absolutely, brings all the pieces of the puzzle together.
Now, how are you enabling students to live their dreams?
I love talking to students because students have so much passion and they really don't see any limits. It's just, it's empowering to talk to students. They empower me in many ways. But what I try to do when I'm talking to students is find out what their interests are. One of the things we do very simply is the DreamSpark program. There's DreamSparks for universities, and there's also a DreamSpark program for students. So we make sure that students have access to free software as well. So if they want to explore what would it be like to, you know, build an application. We give them free software through the DreamSpark program. If they want to explore the mobile space, we even waive the fee for students to create a marketplace account. So they actually get to publish Windows Phone applications at no charge. We have, we also have, and this is one of my favorite things to talk to students about, is the Imagine Cup competition. Because the Imagine Cup competition is really something that we use to try and inspire students to take their ideas and implement them and try and make a difference in the world.
Yeah, it's kind of a great segue to my next question, and that is, can you describe the Imagine Cup in more detail and how the audience can support the Imagine Cup or get connected?
Oh, absolutely. The Imagine Cup is just this incredible competition. This year is the 10th anniversary of the Imagine Cup. And basically, the idea of the Imagine Cup is students are asked to solve a problem using technology. And that problem can be big or small. You're encouraged to, if you can't think of an idea, look at the UN's Millennium Goals for ideas, like, you know, can you come up with an idea that will help solve hunger, solve poverty, solve equality issues, solve health problems. But having said that, if a student can really be inspired by any problem that they would like to make a difference in. Last year's winners actually developed an application that would help inform drivers of traffic problems, because in Ireland, traffic deaths are one of the leading causes of death in youth. So that was something they felt strongly about, and that was what they chose to focus in on. There have been people who've developed games to help kids having trouble with math, personal tutors, things that will sort of track the movement of disease in certain areas using maps. It's just incredible to see what these students come up with. So, and what we do is they'll be typically all around the world, because this is not a Canadian competition. This is a worldwide competition. And every country will be encouraging university students and college students to participate in the program by competing. And then, you know, the top entries get chances to go to sometimes a local final. This year we happen to be having a Canadian final. And some of them get opportunities to go to the worldwide finals, which last year were in New York City. This year they're in Australia. And I have talked to students who have attended those worldwide finals, and it can be an absolute life-changing experience. Some of them actually change the direction of their career path as a result of being part of Imagine Cup. And they even have grants now, which they're offering to some of the Imagine Cup participants to give them a chance to actually implement their ideas. So it's not just entering competition. It's about trying to bring those ideas to life as well. So that's what the Imagine Cup is. How can your audience sort of get involved and support it? There's a few different ways you can do that. One is simply to raise the awareness of it. If you know professors and students, you know, encourage the students to consider getting involved inside the Imagine Cup. If you're a professional, you can mentor a team. A team is encouraged to have a mentor to just sort of give them a little guidance on the way, give them some ideas of what they could develop. Sometimes a mentor is somebody from a local charity who's asking some students to help them. And what the students build to help them becomes an entry into Imagine Cup. So mentoring a team, encouraging students to get involved, spreading awareness. And, you know, there are some ways to even get involved in things like sponsorship. That's where some of the grant money has come actually from sponsorships to bring things to life.
Now, do you have any deadlines each year, sort of approximate deadlines that people can target?
For the Imagine Cup deadlines, it usually starts in September and October. That's when you can usually find out what the year's competitions are going to be, where the worldwide finals will be held, and so on. That's usually announced in the September-October timeframe because it's sort of designed to coincide with the academic year. So the deadlines are typically at the end of the second term. So, for example, March 13th is the deadline this year for the software design competition, software design being one of the more popular categories. Because it's a very broad-based category. You can use any .NET technology. You can use Connect. You can use Azure. You can use Phone to build a solution. So it's a very open-ended competition and very popular. And no deadlines are typically in the March time frame for entering. And that way they have the finals. If there are local Canadian finals, for example, we'd have those. This year we're having it April 30th after exams are done. And the worldwide finals are usually in the summer. This year they'll be in July.
Now we're going to switch gears a bit, and we're going to sort of mine all of this development expertise you have as really an acknowledged, well-respected program lead in development and as an actual developer as well. So can you profile what makes for good software architecture and how it can best be done?
When you're a good software architecture, to me, has to have a few definite characteristics. One, the code has to be reusable. I'm a big believer that if you design your code to be reusable, the next time you're doing an application, you'll be able to say, hang on, we wrote that over here. Let's reuse the code we've got. The code you write has to be maintainable. There is no way you can ever convince me that the code I wrote, someone else isn't going to have to update or change it later. You know, one of the guaranteed truths of life is the requirements will always change. So making your code maintainable is absolutely crucial. And for the same reason, it also has to be adaptable. Because, as I mentioned, requirements do change, and you have to make sure that you design your code in such a way and your architecture in such a way that if there's a change in requirements, you don't have to throw at everything and start all over again. So those are some of the key things I think about. I also believe you have to try and think about cross-platform as well. These days, it's getting more and more unusual for an application to live in only one space. An application that lets somebody check in for an airline. Well, now people want to be able to check in. They need to be able to do that with a travel agent's computer. They want to be able to do that on their mobile devices, on phones. They want to do that on tablets. They want to do that over the web. So thinking about the cross-platform support of doing that, and some of them will be on Macs, and some of them are going to be on PCs, and some of them are going to be on Android and BlackBerry phones, and some of them may be on Windows phones. So you need to think about the cross-platform support right away from the get-go as well. So those are some of the key elements I think of when you're looking at a good software architecture. And some of the ways you implement that are through good object-oriented design, through separating your responsibilities so you don't have code in one place that's managing the user interface and managing your business rules and managing interfacing with your database, breaking that up. That makes your code more reusable and more flexible. And also things like cloud services and web services, which I think help with the interoperability across platforms and with the reusability as well.
And it's kind of interesting. I taught programming for probably 20 years, and it's interesting. All of your tips are so kind of classical tips in a way.
Yep, they are classical tips, but, you know, it's unfortunate. You know what I've often heard is, or often said, is unfortunately common sense is not always common practice.
that's very true. Now, I recently had an interview with Terry Cota, and he's a very famous developer, but he's just so enthused about Microsoft technologies. So can you profile the evolution of Microsoft technologies to better support design?
Well, there's been some evolutions on a few different areas. When I was first programming in Microsoft technologies, I was probably programming VBA inside Microsoft Access. And I'll tell you, it's going from VBA in the days of VB3 and to VB6. I mean, it was a programming language, but it wasn't fully object-oriented. So the evolution to .NET was a great step forward. .NET had some great interoperability because one .NET language could talk to another .NET language much more effectively. So the interoperability improved with .NET. Working with the DLLs became a lot simpler when we went to .NET from the VB6 world, and where we were always working with the APIs. We used to have to register all our DLLs and things like that, so it was difficult in terms of maintenance. It expressed challenges in terms of good code design for the VB programmers. The C++ programmers were all happy because they had OO. VB.NET brought some of those Visual Basic programmers into that object-oriented space so they could design more reusable and code. And then I think the other thing that started happening was increased support for web services as well. And again, web services is one of those technologies that I think is huge from the cross-platform perspective and the reusable perspective. So with .NET, we also saw a much greater increase of support for web services. And you could create a web service and you could consume it from just about any client you wanted. You weren't limited to using .NET to consume your web service. And it was very easy to create a web service in .NET. You have all these SOAP extensions and, you know, all the XML that a lot of people at the time really weren't familiar with. And I'll be honest with you, I would be hard-pressed to write my own logic to manage all the SOAP exceptions and create all the SOAP envelopes. But with the tools like Visual Studio, they made it really easy to start implementing web services by creating proxy classes for you that would actually generate all the code that created the necessary SOAP extensions to call a web service and to receive the data back from a web service. So they made the web services a lot more accessible to the everyday programmer and didn't require the skills, the deep skills that used to be required. So that was a great evolution as well. The other thing we've seen is the cloud services, which is almost the natural evolution from web services. I've worked at a lot of small companies over the years. You know, at the big companies, sure, we had DBAs and we had server administrators. But I worked at a company where I was a sixth employee to join the company. I was the first person to join the company who wasn't a founding member. And we needed email. And we needed an application we could use to track what students were registered for courses. And sure, we could sit down and do all that ourselves. And we started off by installing Exchange on a server, but 3 years later, we got hit with a virus because we hadn't kept our service packs up to date. And, you know, we had a crash and it caused us all no shortage of problems. And it wasn't that we didn't know it needed to be done. It was simply that the person who'd installed Exchange had 52 other things on their plate they were responsible for as well. You know, it wasn't a dedicated Exchange administrator. And we didn't have a dedicated web administrator for our web server either. So we ran into issues there as well. So things like the cloud services, I just have some wonderful capabilities to them because we can still have what we want and put them on someone else's server. So we don't have to worry about the upgrades, applying all the service packs. And yet we know if the company was to grow and we needed more capabilities, it's there if we need it. We know we've got a guaranteed service level. It's very scalable and it's also very reusable from different directions. So I think the cloud has also been a really nice evolution in terms of making things easier to maintain for even a small company. On the website, too, there's been an interesting evolution. I think back to the days of ASP when we were pretty much writing our own code from scratch and almost like creating your web pages in Notepad. Then came ASP.NET, which helped cross the barrier for the Windows developer into the web world. Because it used to be if you'd been a Windows programmer, entering the web space was absolutely terrifying. But with ASP.NET, it became a lot easier for a Windows programmer to start being productive as a web programmer. And there was a need for more web programmers. Because it used the .NET technologies and languages in code behind pages. And those .NET skills, C#, VB.NET, were skills that a Windows programmer already had. Certainly it was helpful to have someone around who still knew their way around HTML and ASP.NET, but a .NET programmer could become productive very quickly. Then we saw things like MVC inside ASP.NET and Model View Controller. And Model View Controller does a fantastic job of that dividing responsibilities, again, thinking about code being reusable, maintainable, adaptable, those basic principles. MVC has been a great example of how that's supported better now in ASP.NET. And now, even more recently, has been the increased support for HTML5 and JavaScript. You know, now you can be developing for web, and Microsoft certainly has taken some big steps now. You look at Windows 8, you can build a Windows 8 application, native application, using HTML5 and CSS. So that comes to that cross-platform story and interoperability story that I think has just gotten stronger over the years.
That's a fascinating sort of background that you provided and so many really great tips. Now, I want to extend that now. Can you share some valuable insights in the whole software development area?
Well, you know, in terms of insights, it really, you know, it comes back a bit to that common sense is not always common practice. So for me, it still comes back to the basics. You know, when you're writing code, assume your code is going to live forever. You know, think back to the days of Y2K panic where people had written code 30 years before and never expected it to still be around in 2000. So I really think simple things like assume your code's going to live forever and then assume someone else is going to have to figure out your code. Even if it's you, I can't think of a number of times I wrote code and then 6 months or 2 years later somebody came back to me and said, Susan, why did you write the code this way? And I'm like, I don't remember. That was 2 years ago. When you're deep in the code, everything seems intuitive. But when you step away from it for a while, you then forget what you were doing. So simple things like commenting your code and good structure and naming principles, again, back to basics. But make sure your code is readable and someone else can follow it. And that includes things like including comments or using good tools that will generate documentation for you. Another one I always like is I'm a big believer that you should assume that even though it's one manager who asked you to write one little tool for them, assume that that customized little specific app will someday be adopted across the company. I had a friend who built an access application for her parents who had a sheep farm. And her parents used this application to keep track of the sheep and when they were going to be sheared and when the last time they'd been lambed was and if they had any medications and so on. Next thing she knows, she discovers that her parents have sent the access files to some farmers out in New Zealand. And she starts freaking out because she's got code in there that says things like, if the sheep's name is Fred, don't forget to give him his penicillin on Friday. She never imagined her application would be scaled out and used by others. It was never designed for that. That happens more often than anybody expects. So I've really gotten to that point where I assume that everything I write is eventually going to get reused. And if it takes me a little longer to write it, it all works out great. And then you look like a hero when somebody else says, hey, I like your app. Can I use it too? And you can adapt it to their needs very quickly. Then there's simple things like, oh, backup, backup, backup. You know, we know that for data, but in software development it's true. Back up your code. We ran into a situation. I was on a project. We were already, a month behind schedule, and something happened that caused us to lose about 2 months' worth of programming. It was a scary situation, and we were running around trying to find our backups. It was an unfortunate series of events that led us to lose the code in the first place. Not something that would happen every day, but it happens. You never expect it, but have your backups, 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 and make sure you can recover from your backups. Requirements will change. You have to. There's no way that you can assume that the requirements you have in front of you are firm and fixed and 100% correct. It's impossible for somebody to give you requirements that are 100% correct. So either they forgot to ask a question or somebody forgot to tell them a requirement or they misunderstood a requirement. That doesn't mean it's not worth getting requirements, but it just means that no matter how good a job someone does, they can't get it 100% right. So requirements will change, so be prepared for that and make sure your process and your code allows for handling those changes when they do come through. I also really am a big believer in Agile. I think Agile has some fantastic practices that we can learn from. Now, I am also, as I've done ITIL and with things like Agile, I'm also a big believer in you don't necessarily have to follow everything by the letter, by the book. You know, you buy a book on Kanban, for example, that talks about how to implement Kanban, and somebody on your team might say, I don't like that particular part of Kanban. I don't want to do it. I don't think we should do it. And someone will stand up and say, but if we don't do it, we're not being agile. When you're implementing any of these sort of methodologies or processes, it's important to say, well, why is that step in the process there? What's it trying to achieve? And if you want to achieve it a different way, by all means do that. Recognize the differences in the types of companies and the ways we work and adapt them the best way to your organization. And I think Agile is a good place to look to find some good practices. For example, one of my favorite is simply, when you do a release, release a useful chunk of functionality. You know, a feature that, not just a feature, but something that's going to give functionality to a user and communicate them into a way. Don't just say, hey, we released a new report and a new form. You say, hey, guess what? In this release, you're getting the ability to register a student for a course and get a list of the students taking a course. That is a lot more meaning to a user than just saying, hey, the new report and form is out. So thinking in terms of useful chunks of functionality when you're doing releases. Those are some of the big, certainly testing. I'm huge on testing. You test as best as you can. Whether you, of course, there again, much like requirements, you will never catch everything. You will never release code that is 100% correct, but you want to catch everything you can with the time you've got. If somebody gives you 2 weeks to test, do the best testing you can in 2 weeks. If they give you 2 years to test, do the best testing you can in those 2 years. It doesn't matter which it is. You're never going to catch everything. Something's going to go live with a mistake, but do the best testing you can with the time you've got. And I guess the other big one is assume that you are going to have to interface to other tools. It's almost impossible these days to have an application that stands alone. So when you're selecting your tools and your software, or you are implementing your tools and your software, think about interfaces and interoperability right from the start.
It's interesting that you mentioned Agile. In fact, I have an interview that's going to be released soon with David Anderson, who was there at the founding of Agile. And of course, sort of is considered the creator of Kanban.
Yep, and there's some fantastic principles and ideas inside those methodologies, so that should be really interesting.
Now, Susan, I'm going to mine again all of the experiences you've had over the years, and You're really the best source of all of this, and that is, you know, there's a working practitioner or computing professional out there, and they're saying, well, you know, there's just billions and billions of links. So that's my question to you. What are your top resources that you use?
Well, one of the first places I do use, if I'm already in the tool and I'm stuck on something specific in code, I'll start with online help. It's amazing how many tools have good online help built in. A lot of times you just, you know, if I'm in Visual Studio, I can just put the cursor over a function name and hit the F1 key and it pops up help on it. Some of the tools, and even if I'm offline, there's built-in help, and Visual Studio actually gives you the option of doing online help as well. If I can't find it there, I will do a search. I will absolutely search, and my first hope is that I find a nice MSDN article on it. Because MSDN, the Microsoft Developer Network, I mean, it is the help documentation that is created by the project team. So I'm always confident that I go there, but this is going to be the, you know, authoritative help on that topic. And often they do have code examples that I can look at to help me out when I'm trying to figure things out. So I look to MSDN for sure. I do buy books. I guess whether it's e-books or paper books, I still use paper books. But when I'm trying to learn a new technology, so as opposed to, okay, I'm in my code and I'm struggling trying to figure out how to use a specific method, that's when MSDN and the help are great. If I'm trying to learn something new, so let's say I decide, okay, I want to learn HTML5 because I'm hearing all this buzz about it, it's getting bigger, I want to get going on that. That's when I actually like to pick up a book, because I find it gives me some background on why I might be interested in HTML5 in the first place, why there's so much buzz about it, and then I can just start working my way through the chapters. Funny enough, I rarely finish the books, because I usually find by the time I'm sort of halfway into it, I understand enough to go and start playing, and then I sort of shift my learning approach. Coworkers. I often turn to coworkers for help, or other people I know that I've met through networking, through different user groups or different societies I might be a part of. I definitely turn to them, either in person or through social media. You know, sometimes I've literally posted on Facebook, help, I'm stuck on X. And next thing I know, I've got two friends pinging me saying, hey, what's the problem you're having, and offering to help. I've done that through Twitter and through Facebook. It's incredible what you can do. So coworkers and friends, both in person and over social media. But search is definitely a great thing. Forums. If you look at Windows 8, there's an incredible forum called Developer Build that is full of people having active discussions, comparing notes on what do you like, what are the problems you're running into, how are you solving those problems. And I do like the official forums, the larger forums, things like the Developer Build, because I love the ones where you get the actual product owners jumping into the conversations. You know, knowing that somebody, Windows 8 being very new, a lot of people aren't quite sure, you know, who to turn to for help. You go to the Developer Build forum, and now you've got somebody from the Windows 8 team asking your question. And whether it's something, a very simple question or a bigger question, it's nice to know that you've got a real authority trying to help you out. And yeah, I think that sort of covers off all the big ones. Oh, the last one would be blogs. When I do a search, there are so many wonderful people out there who are doing development and take the time to share what they've learned in blogs. And they will write these beautiful explanations of why a feature works, why you would use a feature, and examples of how to use the feature, and problems they ran into, and how it helped them, and give you code examples. Those are just fabulous resources. So when I do a search, if MSDN doesn't give me what I want, the next thing I look for is a good blog post.
Well, Susan, you're out there and you're scanning all the different blogs and features and articles and so on throughout the net using MSDN and much more, and talking to your colleagues. So you must have a pretty good idea. What are the sort of disruptive technologies that are around us that we need to be aware of? And then how will they have impact?
Well, to me, a disruptive technology is any technology that does not play well with others. You just don't have applications anymore that you implement and they stand alone. Inevitably, somewhere down the road, you're going to either need to extract data from that application to run custom reports that weren't included with the product, or you're going to want to extract data or load data into it from some other tool. You know, maybe you have an Excel spreadsheet you want to load into it. So there are tons of products out there that do very specific things very well. But I think those technologies are disruptive when they don't play well with others. You know, it can seem like a great idea. You see this nice tool, you go, wow, this isn't very expensive. Let's buy this tool. We can start using it, and we'll do exactly what we want. But late down the road, you always end up paying for it. You know that down the road, you said you're going to need some extra reports that you can't create with the tools that come with that product you purchased. So then you start having to figure out, how do I extract data when you discover there's all these extra APIs you have to pay for or something, or that there is no API, so you'll have to pay to have it customized or customize it yourself. So they have a really negative impact on us in the long term when new technologies come out or new products come out, and we need them to talk to each other. I really believe that a good technology, that any software that's implemented, should play well with others and should be able to interface with other applications.
Now you're going to work on sort of in the role of advisor to computing professionals and businesses out there. Again, you have a great idea in terms of what's out there in the landscape and things that people should be watching for, or opportunities that they should embrace perhaps. So what are these specific challenges and opportunities that IT workers or computing professionals and businesses should embrace today and into the future?
I think there's a few different areas in that. Some are a little scarier. Some are just exciting and fun to play with. One of the ones I think that we have to embrace today and over the next years is the cloud. The concept of the cloud services, where instead of us having everything hosted ourselves on our own servers, the idea of hosting it on someone else's servers, someone else's infrastructure, there's some real cost savings potential there, both in terms of having to pay for the hardware itself, like buying the extra servers. You know, you're a small company just getting started up. I don't want to have to buy 3 servers just so I can set up a cluster for backup and recovery purposes, or to ensure high availability so that if, you know, something goes down, everything can recover. I don't want to have to invest in UPS power supplies to get high availability. So, you know, small companies are embracing cloud very quickly, because they immediately see the benefits of it. But when you're a large company and you're used to having everything at your fingertips where you can touch it, sometimes they find the cloud a bit scary to embrace. But you can embrace it in small ways to start. Consider using the cloud for your developer environment and for your testing environment, for example. Great ways to do your performance testing without buying a whole bunch of extra servers. And I really think, said the cloud is definitely becoming the way of the future, and I think it's something we're going to see more of, not less of. So we all need to get a little bit more comfortable with the cloud and what we need from the cloud and how that fits into our long-term plan. One of the other ones would be the mobile world. 15, 20 years ago, it was all about web. Every company was like, ooh, we must need a website. I'm not sure why I need a website, but I need a website. That same sort of revolution is happening right now in the mobile space. Everybody's like, ooh, I need to be on mobile, and I need to be able to deal with mobile inside my company. So trying to figure out how to enter that mobile space, and it can be confusing. You have the decision of, should you just design a website that works well on a mobile device? Should you build native applications for mobile devices? And then you run into the challenge of, if you do you support iPhone? Do you support Windows Phone? Do you support BlackBerry? You know, because they're different for every platform, and how do you minimize your investment but still support mobile devices? But there's a huge opportunity in mobile, and even now, it may seem like everybody's got a smartphone, but we're still at a point where the majority of the population doesn't have a smartphone yet. So that demand for mobile is only going to increase, and it's interesting to watch today's youth. They are so comfortable on those mobile devices, but equally true, my father's, you know, got himself a smartphone as well, and already exploring it and discovering it. It's very popular with consumers, and it's a great way to interface with consumers. So much like we had the web revolution, we're really seeing a bit of a mobile revolution now that we have to embrace and plan in our strategies how we are going to meet the needs of a mobile consumer. And finally, and to me this is the fun one, new user experiences. The technologies that have come out in the last 5 years are straight out of Star Trek and James Bond movies. With things like Kinect, touchscreen technologies, voice recognition, we have the possibility now of brand new user experiences that we can create that make work seem less like work, if you will, that really have the opportunity to delight a user. And that's a powerful thing. It's really interesting. I was watching a video the other day. I was doing a blog post about some features on Kinect. And I found a wonderful example. somebody had taken Kinect. It was actually a store, and they'd set up a television, and the Kinect would scan your body and project you on the television, so you saw a picture of yourself, and then you could select different fashions and try them on and see what you looked like wearing the different fashions just by waving your hand, scrolling from one item to another, change the color of the item, and so on. The technology to do this, it used to be things like that were technologies that might have cost $10,000, but, you know, a Kinect is $150, I think, at the moment, something like that. So accessible in terms of a price point now that now we can leverage this and have fun with it. And let me tell you, the people, you know, were playing with it. And what an experience for a company to have people playing with their products, excited about exploring the products instead of seeing it as a chore. And they really were. It was, of course, highly entertaining to see the some of the gentlemen trying on the prom dresses. But it simply was that. It was a delighting experience for the user. And sometimes I think we forget that using one of our applications can be a delightful experience instead of work. And I think that's something to really strive for in the years to come with the technology we have at our fingertips now.
Susan, if we can now look even beyond sort of the technologies you described already, like mobile, the cloud, sort of the immediate new user experiences, what kind of innovation should we be watching for, let's say, in 5 years' time?
You know, I was talking to someone about that last week. I was chatting with a student saying, with everything that's happened in the last 5 to 10 years, I can only imagine where it's going to happen in the next 5 years. And it's stretching my brain to try and imagine, because we're already in that science fiction space now in terms of the books I was reading. But I do think we're going to see more and more virtual environments. We already have 3D televisions, so I don't think we're that far from 3D sort of projectors. So, you know, imagine Skype, if you will, but with a hologram of a person, maybe, rather than simply a 2D image of a person. So the 3D technologies are getting stronger and stronger. I think those holograms we saw in Star Wars when R2-D2 was, you know, showed Leia saying, "Help me, Obi-Wan, you're my only hope." I think those are just around the corner, I really do. I think we're going to see more remote working and remote consuming, where we're already at the point where users shop from home at Christmas now. I wouldn't be surprised. I haven't seen statistics on it, but I wouldn't be surprised if we're approaching the point where people do as much Christmas shopping online as they do in the physical stores. And I think we're going to see more shifts like that as well, where people are doing things remotely, and there'll be more and more experiences that people will be able to do from home and won't have to drive somewhere to do. I don't know whether it's things like trying on clothes, said seeing a vision of themselves standing in front of their computer and being able to virtually try on clothes, I think, is an example of that. We're not quite there yet. But I think, you know, sort of Kinect technology built right into your laptop, for example. So I think, said, more remote technologies that will enable remote experiences, I think, is sort of a direction I can predict in the next 5 years. But that's purely guesswork.
Susan, I'm going to stretch you a bit more, and maybe let's go out 20, 30 years. Do you believe in this idea of a singularity from Kurzweil, you know, where humans and machines merge, and you can't predict the future anymore because it just evolves so quickly? You can download your consciousness into a computer, or this whole concept of quantum computing and quantum entanglement and sort of infinite computing capability?
Well, you know, it's interesting because with all the advances we've made, the one place where science fiction is still science fiction is in that field of artificial intelligence. We have really discovered how challenging it is. I did a little bit when I was in electrical engineering. I remember attending some sessions, and it was a simple example of you would hold up, a mouse in front of a computer, and it would scan it and say, "That's a mouse." But if you turned the mouse 17 degrees, it didn't recognize the mouse anymore. It's incredible the complexities required for perception, balance. I mean, yes, we've been able to build robots that play hockey. There was one, I believe, at University of Manitoba that does that. There are, you know, the Roomba robots that are running around vacuuming in the house. But, you know, the Jetsons housemaid who runs around and cleans everything is still an awfully long way off. So I think the challenge we face now, rather than just predicting the technology, is simplifying the complexity of technology. I was at a lecture delivered by Bill Buxton, who's a real guru on user experience. And he was talking about a challenge that we face, which is the number of technologies we touch every day just keeps going up and up and up. Just think about launching your laptop, the number of applications you have in there, and the number of devices. You've got USB device. You've got smartphones, and then you've got Bluetooth to your smartphone, and your smartphone connects into your car and so on. And the problem is our capacity for learning hasn't changed. We can understand a certain level of complexity, yet we're faced with increased and increased technological complexity and technology choices. So I think where the challenge will come for us to be able to continue to advance in technology will be in simplifying the interactions with the user so that they can use more complex technologies without having to have more complex skills. So that I actually see as it's not so much a singularity of, you know, reaching those types of limits. I see it more as we're reaching a threshold where our capacity to use what's in front of us, we might be at our limit. And it'll be the rest of us will be faced with the challenge of trying to simplify that experience so that people can leverage the technologies coming out.
Your comments kind of remind me of an interview I did with Chuck Thacker, and Chuck invented the modern PC. He invented the hardware behind laser printing, parallel computing, tablet computers, parallel processing, what else? Oh, the hardware behind the internet. So, and he kind of speaks of the same thing, this sort of simplification, and it's not quite there yet, you know.
We've come up with some amazing technologies. Now we have to figure out how to present them and use them in such a way that doesn't intimidate and just make everything more complicated. I sometimes joke that computers allow us to make mistakes now faster than ever.
Oh, I recall watching a movie, Blade Runner, recently, and the time frame was 2019.
Yep.
And there's no way we're going to achieve that. Or, you know, watching many, many years ago, 2001 Space Odyssey, and of course, 2001 is long past, and of course, we haven't even come close, except maybe a little bit on the computing side.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's a few Star Trek moments that, you know, ring true. You know, some of the scanners and, you know, the voice comms. But, yeah, there's still, especially in that artificial intelligence and the idea of, you know, simulant robots from Blade Runner, we're a long way off that.
Now, can you describe some areas of controversy in the areas that you work in?
Well, the areas where I work, some of the ones that I run into most frequently, one of them is the agile versus waterfall debate when you're doing development. A lot of companies have been doing waterfall development for years, and agile scares them because they look at the agile manifesto that says, you know, and they read that to say no documentation, and they go, we can't possibly have no documentation. Well, if you look at it, agile manifesto doesn't actually say never write documentation. But that's certainly one of the areas that I see a lot of controversy around, of what's better, agile versus waterfall, and if you're doing agile, which agile methodology is best. You said you see things like the Kanban popping up. So that's one of the ones I see out there on a fairly regular basis. And again, what's right, you really have to look at your organization, your goals, what you're trying to achieve. Another one is coming back to cloud again, the cloud versus on-premise. Should we host things ourselves or should we host things in the cloud? You know, when we're writing our code and the whole virtualization revolution that's going on. There are definitely some opportunities. And to me, it always comes back to what are your goals? When you're trying to decide, should I go with cloud, should I go with on-premise? If I was to make the investment to shift from on-premise to cloud, what are my benefits going to be? What's going to be my return on investment? Because there's going to be an investment in shifting from one to another. So you have to have some very clear understanding of what your return on investment is going to be, and that you will see benefits from making the shift. Another interesting one that's much more specific is in the mobile space is the whole question of how to support mobile. You know, should you build a mobile website or should you build a native app? That's a really very specific debate that you see going on all the time. Because if I build a nice web page that supports mobile pages, and there's some HTML5 features, for example, there's one called Media Queries that allows you to change the way a web page displays based on the screen size that's viewing it. So it works very well for laptop, big monitors, small tablet-sized devices, or even smartphones. So it really crosses the gamut. So you go, well, I can build a nice website. Why would I write a native app? Well, it's a different, really, and it really is a different paradigm. The web apps are great. They can absolutely be the right solution. But how is someone going to discover your web app? When you write a native app, all these different smartphones have marketplaces where people can go and search for that particular application. They can post links to that application to their friends. There's a whole infrastructure and environment, if you will, around the native applications. And they can do things with the device itself. If you look at a smartphone, for example, it's got a camera. It's got GPS. It's got an accelerometer so it can tell you how it's being tilted. And so there are features. It's got microphones. It's got speakers. A laptop or a desktop may not necessarily have these things. So when you build a native application, you can, again, build a more rich experience for the user and something that, again, will come back to that idea of delighting a user, providing this incredible experience. It's very exciting. Also, typically, smartphones and tablets tend to be touch-based. And, you know, it's funny, there's touch is another one of the sort of controversial areas, touch versus mouse and keyboard. It's interesting, if you think about it, how often you work with touch screens every day. We actually work with them a lot. But that touch experience is a different one we can offer as well, better through a native app than through a web mobile. But with a native app, you have to write code for all the different platforms. You have to write a BlackBerry app, you have to write a Windows Phone app, you have to write an iOS app, and you have to write an Android app, and the Android app has to support the different types of devices that Android supports. So it's a lot bigger cost investment to do that. So that's a really challenging issue, and again, there's no right, wrong answer. You have to look at your specific needs, what you're trying to achieve to make the right decision. Open source, always another great debate. You know, should you go with open source? You know, there will always be people who will say, oh, I don't want to use .NET. It's not open source. And it's you know, I respect that, and everybody should be able to make their own decisions for their own reasons. I personally am more comfortable using tools like .NET because I love knowing I have support behind it, but I can call the company and say, hey, this isn't working. What's wrong with your stuff? Whereas with open source, I kind of feel like I'm out on my own if anything goes wrong because this isn't something that's, you know, supported. So I actually said I'm more comfortable working in an environment where I've got that support. But again, personal choices. And I said, and yes, the interesting one that's going on is the whole thing of, is touch going to be the future? And touch-based technologies, I mean, I don't think the mouse and keyboard's going anywhere. I'm never going to, I don't see myself ever creating Word documents and doing complex AutoCAD systems with a finger touch on a tablet. But we use touch every day. You go to the bank machine, you take out money, you're using touch. You go to the airport to check into a flight, you're using touch. The other day I was at a rental car agency, and the agreement, instead of signing the document, I'm checkboxing all the boxes, say, yes, I decline the prepaid insurance, I agree that I will fill up the tank before I show and pack. It was all done by a touchscreen, and you tapped the I agree button, and then there was a stylus, and you signed your name at the bottom. Touch is very widespread, and it's amazing. I think coming back to that, making things easy for people, you watch a kid, and they just walk up to a touchscreen, and they work with it, and they start playing with it instantly. It comes back to that, delighting the user. They want to touch it. And it comes very naturally to them. You know, I touch it and I bring it, drag it to where I want it to be. So, but there's a lot of, you know, still some questions about, you know, whether an application should be designed for touch or should be designed for mouse or keyboard. And, well, my answer is all of the above. But again, it always comes back in every controversy to me to what do you want to achieve. And when you make a decision, just make sure you make an educated decision.
So, Susan, we're going to do another switch here in terms of the direction of questions. And this time we're going to talk about, you know, user groups or associations out there. What is the value in professional associations for computing professionals?
I think there's a huge value in associations for computing professionals. It's interesting. I when I'm talking to university students, in university, you're part of a community. You've got the other kids I shouldn't call them kids. You've got the other students who are in your faculty. You know, you've got the Computer Science Association. You've got the Electrical Engineers Association. And you get together on a regular basis. And you enter competitions together. And you help each other out when you're doing assignments and projects. So you have this wonderful community. And it's a very exciting and fun time. And when they graduate, sometimes they get out and they're sort of lost, because they miss that camaraderie, that group and that support group they had around them in university. And I think that's where some of those professional associations step up. They provide a sense of community. They give you a way of networking so you can discover people working in doing similar work in other fields, and that gives you access to people who have experience that you can ask questions to or potentially find new job positions down the road. It's also great for staying informed. My goodness, there's so much happening in the technology industry. No one person could be expected to keep up with it all. I mean, it's my job to try and stay on top of developer technologies just from Microsoft. And I'll tell you, I still get developers who walk up to me and go, Susan, what do you think of X? And I go, I didn't even know about that. There's just so much happening. So being part of a professional association is a great way to keep yourself informed of at least all the big stuff. You know, you have user group meetings or you get newsletters just to keep you appraised of the big things that are happening, the big shifts that are happening in technology. Because, you know, if you graduate and you take a job and you are programming for 3 years, you may sort of stick your head out 3 years later and go, wow, everything's changed. What happened? By being part of a professional association, that keeps you in the know and keeps you connected.
There's a large number of recognized professions out there, and there's professional associations around them like architects and engineers, accountants, doctors, lawyers, and so on. And there's this whole idea of quality assurance when you belong to that association and you have credentials from that association, or managing risk to the public, risk to clients. Again, when you belong to an association and you're credentialed, there also is demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, and some mobility, because there's this kind of universal standards that are being applied. This hasn't really happened in computing yet. So what are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession with this sort of quality assurance, risk management, where the public and the client interests are protected, where there's demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, and recognized credentials?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I'm an electrical engineer, so I was required to take an ethics course as part of my degree. And it was one of those courses when you're a university student, you don't necessarily appreciate the value of learning those basic ethics. But, you know, working in the computer science, now I work more in computer science areas than I do in the engineering profession, but I still find myself falling back to some of those basic ethics and some of those principles that were taught to me. So I think it is really important people think about ethics in computing, you know, things like copyright, you know, are you just copying somebody's image and reusing it in an appropriate way, legal licensing, you know, people have this sort of view that, you know, oh, borrowing that CD from my friend and just installing it on my computer is perfectly fine. So there certainly are some ethics that I think people need to think about inside the computing science profession. And I do think there's a value in having a recognized profession and with some standards and so on set behind it. And if you look at it, you're seeing more of this absolutely in industry. You have the project management, PMP. Even business analysts have the CBAP, Certified Business Analyst Professional. And it's really when you can have a recognized credential of some sort, it gives you some credibility. It gives a confidence level because, and there are some things that are common to computing professionals. We talked earlier about some of those, what makes up good soft architecture, and I said, oh, maintainability, reusability, and you were saying yourself, I was teaching that 20 years ago. That hasn't changed. There are some basic principles that just apply to good programming, and there are some ethics associated with good programming. So I think it's there's a lot of value in getting it more recognized as a profession and formalizing some of those skills so that an employer can really feel like, okay, this person, yes, they've built 6 web pages and, you know, they built a cool website, but do they really understand how to build an architecture? Are they going to be ethical in their practices at my company and not, I'll give another example of an unfortunate situation. I saw a company that paid somebody to build a website for them, and they paid a fair amount of money to have the website built. The website was implemented, and then 3 months later, they saw a twin of that website implemented for another company. So the client who had built their website turned around and resold their property to another company, and they were faced with the potential of going, well, do we sue them? What do we do? But they paid for development work, and then the developer turned around and resold that work. So, you know, there certainly are some ethics involved, and I said, I think having it recognized in professional association with some core skills and principles would make a lot of sense.
We're down to our last series of questions. This one's a bit of a stretch, I think, in terms of sort of discussing it, because you're going to have to do some forecasting and sort of get into the minds of senior executives out there. And anyways, in this first question, if you can share your deep insights into some of the emerging discussions about technologies that are happening versus, let's say, CIOs versus CTOs. And the topic areas would be things like technology to grow revenue versus technology to increase efficiencies, the impact of business driving the technology decisions, technology perspectives from the customer's point of view, this whole concept, are CIOs become the chief innovation officer? Is their role changing? And maybe some other hot topics that would be of interest to this particular segment, that is CIOs versus CTOs.
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting. And when I did a lot of work in ITIL, I quite frequently found myself talking to CIOs and CTOs about the world of ITIL. And actually, that's one of the hot topics, is the whole question of, you know, should you implement something like ITIL or Microsoft Solution Framework? And so I'll start with that one and my thoughts around that area. Anytime you're implementing any sort of methodology, be it ITIL or Microsoft Solution Framework, it's important not just to implement the letter of the process, but to understand the reasons behind the process. So, you know, when you talk about change management, for example, and managing change, there's, you know, a process suggested by ITIL and MSF on how you manage change. And it's a frequently implemented process, and people would often come up to me and say, well, we're doing it this way, but that's not ITIL, is it? To which I would say, well, look at the goals of the process. Why do you do change management? And if you look at ITIL, you look at MSF, they'll say you're doing change management to make sure that changes are assessed, changes are justified, and changes are authorized. So I always just challenge them to say, is what you're doing making sure things are assessed, authorized, and justified? If the answer is yes, then you're living the spirit of ITIL and MSF. It's okay to tweak. Just think about, are you meeting the goals of that process? Because in the end, it's about return on investment. So it comes back a bit to that first one you mentioned, that sort of relates to the using technology to grow revenue versus using technology to increase efficiencies. I think you need to do both. Anytime you're implementing technology, there should be a reason for that. And you should be looking for a return on investment. It may be more money, flat and simple. You may be saving money by implementing a particular technology. You may be exposing yourself to a new market by building a new mobile application. You may be saving money by implementing on the cloud. You may be trying to increase efficiencies by implementing a tool like Visual Studio 11. You take a look at that. One of the great stories around Visual Studio 11 is its capability to support the entire application lifecycle. Your requirements are in the tool, and then you assign the code to programmers through the tool, and we can do code reviews right inside the tool, and you can test inside the tool. So the way it crosses boundaries reduces inefficiencies because people aren't going back and forth and having to import and re-enter data in different places. All of those are good reasons to implement technology. So I'm a real big believer in using technology for both growing revenue and increasing efficiency, as long as you have clear expectations up front of why you're implementing that technology. And you're not just implementing the technology because it's there. There's nothing I dislike more than somebody who comes back from a conference and goes, this tool is cool, we need it. And then you implement it and go, well, you know, what are we getting for our money later? And then people don't like the tool, but you really have to have understand what it's for. Sometimes, for example, people implement SharePoint, you know, impact of business driving technology decisions. SharePoint, sometimes I've seen it implemented because it's a buzzword, but it's not just a tool that you have to implement to do collaboration. There has to be a strategy behind it, somebody thinking about why we're doing it and what we're looking for from it. So impact of business driving technology decisions, business should drive technology decisions, in my opinion. Technology should push up and highlight, I think it's the technical team's responsibility to highlight new tools that become available that can help the business. But in the end, every tool that you implement should help the business in some way, shape, or form, so should be justified for business reasons. And said from the customer point of view, said, yeah, just always take a step back and look at why you're doing it. Look at all the competing products before you make a final decision. Think about how this product's going to serve you in the short term as well as the long term before you make a final selection. And I liked your question about sort of a bit about the CIO's role. You know, are the CIOs really becoming the chief innovation officers these days? I think the CIOs, the CTOs, I think, typically are more aware of innovative technologies out there. But I think the CIO can be innovative in figuring out how the company can best use the technologies. So both the CTO and the CIO, I think, are responsible for keeping the company innovative and working towards the future and coming up with new ideas. Said CTO, I think, needs to be on top of what's happening with technology, and the CIO needs to be helping, working with the CTO to figure out how we can be innovative at the company with that particular technology.
Let's take another sort of question, and this time sort of directed at you know, at the level of the governance side or the board side. So if you could share your insights into the governance of board and a candid discussion amongst the board members about things like, you know, what are the top three concerns as it relates to the integration of technology and business or to the board? Who should the board members rely on within the organization, or what should a board do or be involved with in terms of deploying an IT governance program? How should the board be involved in innovation and its impact on the organization's future success? And should the board be involved in preparing the workforce for the future?
I'm a big believer in governance. Having spent a lot of time doing the ITIL, ITIL really relies on governance because so often there is this disconnect between the business plans and vision and the technology teams. So, you know, you need a broader plan when you're thinking about your technology. And I think that's one of the top concerns for a governance board is having that bigger picture of the technology and across all the teams and really having a broader plan of how the technology is supporting the business and following our vision and following our mission. Because, you know, the company has specific goals they're trying to achieve. And in the end, even the technologies you implement should be helping the company drive towards those goals. And, you know, focusing on your core strengths, on your core business and so on. So I think it's important for the board to make sure that they're looking at the technology decisions and making sure they support the broader plan of the company and they do support the vision going forward. And this is one of the things I think the board can do that I think sometimes often gets missed is they can sort of see how that technology is used across teams and really thinking about it, because sometimes you get organizations where you've got one team of people doing ASP.NET, one team of people doing HTML JavaScript, and I think there's efficiencies that you lose when you start implementing five different technologies in the same company. So I think it's part of the governance is to make sure that we're thinking on from the bigger picture cross-team as well. I also think part of governance is, or, you know, one of their concerns has to be around training and supporting people with the technologies as well. You know, if I give you a universal remote control and say, here you go, now you only need one remote control to use your television. Life should be much easier now. Have you ever tried to program one of those universal remote controls? It is really difficult to get those things up and running. Once they're all programmed, they're great. But if you just hand me the remote control and you don't give me the training to figure out how to use it, how to program it, how to set it up properly, what to do when I get a new television, how do I set it up, what kind of problems I'm going to run into with it, you know, how do I know, how do I debug it when something's blocking one of the sensors, then it becomes a point of frustration for me. So I also think that part of the governance has to be making sure that we're not just thinking about the technology we're implementing, but how we're supporting the team in implementing that technology as well through things like training and through process. I'm going to come back to SharePoint for a second because SharePoint is a favorite thing to run into issues with. A lot of people implement SharePoint and say, here you go, you have SharePoint now. Start sharing your documents on it. And that's kind of like asking somebody, saying, look, here's a library. If you've got a book, open the door and throw it in. And then 6 weeks later or a month later or 6 years later, coming back to that library, try to find the one book you threw in there 2 months ago when everybody else has been throwing their books in the same library. You have to have a process where you plan how things are going to be stored, who's going to store what where, what are we going to archive, when will we archive things. So there has to be a process that supports the technology as well. And I think that's one of the other places that has to be a concern for the governance board is making sure we're not just implementing technology, but we're implementing the necessary processes around it to make sure we're using that technology correctly. And so there's who do board members rely on in the organization? I think they have to rely on members of the technical team to keep them abreast of updates in technology. So I would expect a technology manager working in programming to be kept abreast of what's happening in the industry and giving me advice on, hey, we should be considering moving forward to this version of this tool. There's a new release out. I think we should start talking about our plan of when we're going to upgrade to the newest version. So I think the technical teams are a big issue, big resource. The business owners as well, they'll tell you their pain points and what their needs are and what needs aren't being met. And the support teams, I think sometimes those maintenance teams and the folks at the help desk are sometimes ignored. They know a lot of the pain points people encounter every day, so they're a really good resource as well. I would want like a service desk manager to be reporting to the board as well. When you're deploying an IT governance program, I think it's a very good thing. So the main reason I'm a big believer in IT governance is it helps avoid that disconnect between what the business is trying to achieve and what the technical teams are trying to achieve, and making sure we're all working towards the same goal. I think the IT governance can help with innovation which will have impact on the organization's future success. There's a simple quote that basically says, if you keep doing the same thing, you're going to get the same results. As a company, I'm assuming we want to achieve greater results. We want to achieve more. We want to achieve it cheaper. We want to achieve it at a greater scale. You can't achieve that doing the same thing over and over again. So it's up to the IT governance and the governance to really figure out how can we leverage the right technology opportunities to take us to that next level, to make the company more successful going into the future. And how can they help prepare the workforce for the future through training and creating an environment that accepts change? That's a real challenge, I know. But part of that comes through being supportive when there is change and providing training when there is change. People fear change because they're worried when they arrive the next day they won't know what to do. When you support them through that change and you provide the training to handle that change, they're going to be more accepting of it when it comes through.
You do a lot of traveling, you do a lot of speaking, you do blogging and so on. Do you have any interesting stories to share? Maybe something that's funny or surprising or amazing and so on?
Oh, well, yes, I've spent a lot of time on the road. So there's a couple of stories that jump to mind which were fun on road trips. I frequently catch early morning flights, and the reason I'll do that is so I can be home with my kids the night before. And that means every now and then I'm throwing things into my suitcase at 6 in the morning, and I don't want to turn on all the lights because I don't want to wake up my poor husband who's, you know, got to watch the kids and so on while I'm gone. So I was flying to Toronto, and I got up in the morning, and I got to the hotel and dug out my bag to dig out my shoes to wear to teach the course because I was traveling in winter boots, it being January. And I got out and I realized, oh, I brought one black and one navy blue shoe with me. And I thought, oh, well, that's going to look kind of silly, but not much I can do about it. One black, one blue. In the dark, they look the same. And I do have a habit of buying three pairs of shoes that are just different colors because I hate shoe shopping. And then I thought, oh, well, I'll just live with it. I'll wear one black, blue, one black, one blue. The students will get a kick out of it. And then I realized they were both for the left foot. So that didn't work out too well, and I ended up spending the week teaching in winter boots for 2 days, and then I just gave up and bought a new pair of shoes. Another one of the more entertaining moments, I was staying at a hotel in Montreal, and in the middle of the night, I was fast asleep, and some noise woke me up, and it was this buzzing, ringing noise. And I looked over at the clock, and it was 2:30 in the morning, and I thought, oh, somebody must have accidentally left their alarm on for an early morning flight in my hotel room. And I hit the snooze button a couple of times, played with the switches, and realized it wasn't the alarm clock, it was the phone. At this point, I started to freak out because I thought the only person who would call my hotel at 2:30 in the morning would be a family member if something was really bad. So adrenaline was pumping. I go answer the phone, and I get a very polite, "Good morning, Mrs. Ibach. I'm sorry to disturb you. This is the front desk." I'm thinking, why on earth are they calling me at 2:30 in the morning? And they said, "I'm really sorry to disturb you. We just need you to leave your room for a little while. If you wouldn't mind coming out of your room and coming downstairs to the lobby, please." I was sort of confused, trying to imagine why on earth I'd have to get out of my room at 2:30 in the morning. And a little part of my brain said, well, maybe there's a fire. And then, you know, it's 2 in the morning. I'm not thinking too clearly. I'm thinking, well, if there's a fire, I probably shouldn't take the elevator. So my next question was, can I take the elevator? To which they said, oh, it's okay. The police will escort you. They're waiting for you outside your door. And I'm like, the police? I took a look at the peephole of the hotel room and door, and there was no one there. So I went and threw some clothes on, got out of my pajamas, and stepped out the door and looked to the left and looked to the right. On either end of my hallway was SWAT team in full gear with the shields, the helmets, guns out at the ready. And all I could think was, hang on, if the riot SWAT guys are at either end of my hallway looking at me, whoever it is they're trying to get and they're worried about shooting them must be right about where I am. And sure enough, one of the police officers sort of gestured at me with a, you know, shushing motion and sort of gestured me to come over and follow him. And I trotted down the hallway as, you know, quietly as I could around the corner. And I, you know, it's funny how your brain works in these moments. The only thing I could think to myself as I was trying to go quietly down the hallway was, if the police want to be quiet at 2:30 in the morning, they really shouldn't wear windbreakers because they really make a loud shush, shush, song, that wonderful shushing sound every time they took a step. So that was certainly an experience. And I think, but I would like to finish on one of the more positive, happy moments. I did a lot of work installing software at Canada Post. And one of the things I discovered about Canada Post is the number of people they hire with disabilities. I was absolutely blown away and inspired by the number of individuals with different challenges who were able to work at Canada Post. You think of some of the jobs that have to be done there. Here's a job that personally, oh my gosh, I would go crazy if I had to do it. There is a job at the sorting plant when they sort the mail and your letters come in. Machines generally try to read the postal codes. If the machine can't read your postal code, it gets sent to a manual sorter. And what they have is they'll have about six stools, and people sit at those stools, and a letter drops in front of them. They look at the postal code on the letter. They type it into the machine, and the letter shoots off to the right bin. That's all they do all day. But to you and I, we look at that and go, wow, I just couldn't do that all day. But it's a very simple job. It's a very static job. It doesn't require a lot of movement. It doesn't require a lot of manual dexterity. So one of the things I thought just fantastic about Canada Post is said the number of disabled individuals that they have helping them out and working in the plants with productive jobs, earning good salaries. And that really was awesome. And it's made me think ever since, anytime I'm in a company going, you know, where do I have work that I could bring someone in to do that otherwise might have a difficulty finding a job.
We're down to our last question, and this is about areas that maybe I missed, but it just came to mind that I recall you recently gave this fantastic sort of seminar on blogging, like what are the best practices to be a great blogger and how can you make great blogs. Can you maybe give two or three tips from that presentation you gave?
Sure. Yeah, I do a lot of blogging, and one of the great things our Microsoft's been good about is supporting us in our skills, and they gave us a training session on blogging, and I was sharing some of what I'd learned. The first one is very simple. If you're writing a blog post, typically when somebody arrives on a web page, they're going to decide in about 10 seconds whether they want to stay on that web page and read the content or move on. So when you write a blog post, it's really helpful to put a two-sentence summary, maybe in a darker font or italics or something that just sort of jumps out at you, right at the top of your blog that basically describes, what's this blog going to tell me? You know, you can write funny, catchy titles. Those are great. I love those too. But a two-sentence summary right at the beginning of your blog means in 10 seconds, somebody arrives on that site, can look at that summary and know, yes, I want to stay and read that blog, or nope, that's not the information I was looking for and I want to move on. So that was one tip that I find really helps me, and I put that into practice on every blog that I write, and it's such a simple thing to do. The other thing that's very helpful is to use lists. Our eyes are naturally drawn to numbered lists and bullet points. So if you're going to be writing a very long blog with a lot of instructions or making a lot of points, instead of just starting and saying, okay, let's talk about, I'm going to give you the top 10 points. Point number one, here's the title, here's my three-paragraph explanation of that point. Instead of doing it that way, say, I'm going to talk about the top 10 points. Here are the top 10 points. Boom, 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 as a 10-point bullet list. Then you go into the individual ones. Because again, in that 10-second glance at the post, I can see the list of the points you're planning to make. And I might look at it and go, you know, I don't really need to read the first 4 points, but that fifth point is interesting to me. So I might choose to stay, scroll down to the point that interests me. So again, more likely to engage a reader with the content that's going to interest them if I give them a list of what I'm going to cover, and then they can jump to the section that's most interesting to them because we've all got limited time. So those would be two simple things. And the last is simply an image. The old adage, a picture is worth 1,000 words, is certainly true. And if you can, you know, rather than describing to somebody, for example, if you're providing technical instructions on how to do something, a screenshot is much more effective at explaining to somebody how to do something than trying to say, go to the menu and pick file, and then under file, pick tools, and under tools, pick options, and under options, go to the tab called properties, and then scroll down to the third list box on the left. Giving somebody a screenshot is a much more effective way of communicating information sometimes.
And then finally, now to our last question. If you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
That's a dirty question to ask. You know, I had a real hard time trying to think about that one. I know, I appreciated you warning me you were going to ask me that question ahead of time. I think one of the things I would want to ask somebody, myself, or, you know, in the same position of question, would be, what technologies are you excited by? Because there's so much happening right now that I love finding out what different technologies individuals find exciting. And for me, it's voice recognition and Kinect. because, again, I'm going to come back to Bill Buxton, one of the gurus of user experience, and a Canadian as well. And he was talking about how, you know what, you go to a washroom, you wave your hand, and a paper towel comes out. That was Kinect 1.0. You go to a grocery store, you're pushing a cart, and the door magically opens. That was Kinect 2.0. I think I'm very excited by the technologies of Kinect and voice recognition, because I think they'll allow us to enable more experiences like that, which I think will be great for users. Another question was simply, what company or what technologies should a company or school be investing in right now to make sure that they're staying on top of things? And I really think right now that's the mobile space. Mobile is huge. It is growing. It is going to get bigger and bigger. We have not seen mobile technology reach its peak yet in terms of market penetration. So I think any company that hasn't figured out its mobile strategy yet really needs to sit down and figure out what they're going to do to support mobile users, either through web or through native applications. And finally, just the simple, you know, as an obvious wrap-up, where do you imagine yourself being in 5 years? And it's funny because I don't want to ask that question, but I'm not even sure what my answer would be, because I know I'd still be working in technology. Technology excites me. I geek out on technology. I love it. So I could never see myself leaving the technology field. I could see myself returning to teaching in one way, shape, or form, just because I love the teaching, sharing knowledge with others. But at the same time, I have to spend time playing with technology to be a stronger teacher and to be able to keep things real for everybody I'm sharing the information with. And Microsoft is a fantastic company with a lot of different opportunities where I can build those technical skills. I think eventually I'll be in front of a class again one day, but whether that's going to be in 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years remains to be decided, just because Microsoft is a fantastic company to work for with a lot of interesting opportunities. Who knows, I might be helping the SQL Server team in a few years, or working with more with Windows 8. All I know is I'll still be geeking out for sure.
You know, you mentioned Kinect. Where's Kinect for the enterprise?
Kinect for the enterprise? Kinect for enterprise would be in certain tasks I think people would be performing, or for potential remote working and remote situations and experiences. So I could see the Kinect being used for equivalents of conference calls, type remote experiences. I've seen it for virtual showrooms, for example. That's more of an enterprise sort of experience for Kinect. I could see it being used in boardrooms to have experiences when you're doing presentations in a boardroom. You know, imagine sort of waving your hand with the Kinect to slide around what's being shown on the projector rather than going back and using your remote presenter, because a remote presenter mouse just is sort of forward and backward. So I could see the Kinect providing better sort of conference room experiences. And they said there may be some applications and more, I think, in manufacturing industry type enterprises where Kinect may be able to play a role as an interface.
Well, Susan, I really enjoyed this time with you, and I look forward to maybe taking classes with you as you evolve into doing some teaching again.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Now, I know your schedule is demanding, so we are really fortunate that you came in to do this interview, and thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Susan Ibeck, who is empowering developers to improve the world.